No, I don't want to love you. Cause I know how you are.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast. Your game is my middle name, and all the other ones too, of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
Cause I know you could possess my body.
You're listening to Anti-Love Song from the first Bette Davis album back in 1973. There do not appear to be words that capture the fullness of what Bette Davis did in music in the 1970s. Pioneer feels insufficient. Incredible funk musician, a style icon, a shaper of Miles Davis's important shift in the Bitches Brew era, and much, much more. Bette passed away earlier this month. She was 77 years old and had compressed a fascinating career into just a few years, really, in the 70s, and then more or less disappeared. Her music had been long coveted by crate diggers and record collectors, and in the late 2000s, her albums began to be reissued, and more attention was paid to her, and her legacy was beginning to be recovered. There was a documentary a few years ago as well. So we're going to spend this episode of Popcast talking about the career of Bette Davis and the legacy of Bette Davis. And we have the all-star squad here today to do that. First, Doc John Pareles, JP, the chief pop music critic of the New York Times. JP, what's good?
Hi there.
Maureen Mann is here. Maureen is associate professor at NYU's Department of Music and also the author of two books, including Black Diamond Queens, African-American Women in Rock and Roll. And Maureen also wrote a killer JPMS scholarly article about Bette Davis. Maureen, welcome to Popcast.
Thank you, John, and thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Finally, it's my, frankly, one of my OGs, if we're going to be honest. It's Oliver Wang, DJ O-Dub, professor of sociology at CSU Long Beach, and crucially for this conversation, the author of the very extensive and detailed liner notes on the first three Bette Davis album reissues on Light in the Attic. Oliver is also to blame for assigning me 12-inch single reviews in Herb magazine circa 1997, which is ultimately how I have survived this long and am with you today. So, Oliver, welcome, and I'm sorry.
John, I could not take more pleasure in being able to be here with you today and this esteemed squad of people that has been assembled.
It is deeply esteemed. This all is big EMP early popcorn energy. So, big EMP energy on this episode. Bette Davis, I think for everybody on this episode, occupies an outsized place. We all understand the importance of Bette Davis and what she did musically. Maybe let's start with a bit of a twist question, which is, why is Bette Davis's influence not felt maybe as widely outside of our aficionado circles? Let's maybe start with that, and then we'll work backwards.
Part of it is that she was something of an underground figure in her day. And part of being underground was being on an independent label. And it meant she didn't get the circulation and distribution that she might have received on a bigger label. So that's one thing. So not as many people heard her back in the day. Part of the reason that they didn't hear her even being on an independent label is that she was doing some things that were so out there that it made it hard for people who were the gatekeepers to let her through. And so I think that led to less audibility during her time in the 70s, and then that carries over to our time.
We kind of forget in an era where everything is kind of like permanently archived, how unarchived a lot of music was at this time, and how easily songs, albums, and musicians could kind of fade from attention. Oliver, can you talk a little bit about the first two albums, specifically on the independent label that Bette Davis put out, and kind of what they meant, let's maybe say in the 2000s and 2010s, funk aficionados, record collectors, folks like that?
Bette's first two albums came out on Just Sunshine, which was a label that was started by Michael Lang, who was best known for being the promoter behind Woodstock. So he was using that platform to be able to launch his label. So it was independent, I think, relative to the fact that, like, Bette's third album was on Island Records, which is a much bigger label, but it wasn't like it was a tiny label. And I think a lot of the ways in which Bette was both, to the original question, why she didn't map more back in the 70s when her first albums began to come out. And then also why she was rediscovered is her music and her as a personality really just didn't fit into any kind of mold that I think a lot of people could wrap their heads around in, you know, 1973 and 74, which is when her first album started to come out. And so, yes, she was making funk music that had very strong rock and blues and some jazz influences. That's not unheard of. But in terms of the total package, it's really hard to look at Bette Davis and then look at the rest of the R&B funk landscape and say, oh, well, Bette was like, and then fill in the blank, because really she wasn't like anybody else in her particular time period. I think people couldn't really put her into the same box as, let's say, a Lynn Collins or Marva Whitney, who were these earlier funk fatales that were largely produced and had their songs written by someone like a James Brown. They weren't like the people that George Clinton had put forward in the P-Funk era. She was very much on her own as a songwriter, eventually as a producer, picking her bandmates. And I think her sound and style was just unlike anything that we saw in that moment. I think by the end of the 70s, certainly the kind of sexual explicitness in her performances and her lyrics and all those things, that becomes more of the norm, but not when she first emerges. And I think the fact that she wasn't someone that you could easily categorize explains the absence of why she wasn't more in the so-called discourse back then. But for those same reasons, John, I think it's also why when people began to rediscover her music in the 90s and 2000s before her stuff was reissued, it's because she just seems like such an ahead of her time, iconoclastic artist that doesn't, like I said, doesn't fit into any easy boxes. And for people looking to the past to find interesting, inspirational moments that have gone undiscovered, Bette Davis was an ultimate kind of hidden gem, if you will.
JP, can you tell me a little bit about the landscape in 73, 74 that Bette Davis ends up being almost too forward for, too advanced for?
Well, no, almost about it. I was in college radio from 1970 to 74. And
big college radio roundtable today out. Also. All right.
Nasty Gal came in. Jaws dropped. You know, what is this? Who is this? Can we play this on the radio without getting shut down by the FCC?
Let's listen to a bit of Nasty Gal, which is the title track of Bette's third album from 1975.
Bye-bye, I used to love it. Oh, when you did it, turn around.
I don't know how many tune-outs we got from its musical angularity, but there was nothing around like it. I was thinking the only contemporary album that was sort of like what Bette Davis was doing was Millie Jackson's Caught Up, which came out in 1974, a concept album where Millie Jackson is the other woman on side one and the scorned wife on side two. And she's talking about getting what she wants too, but it's a much more old-fashioned soul sound. She's got a horn section. She's not all of these jigsaw puzzle, jagged architectural pieces that Bette Davis was putting together. The sheer sound of Bette Davis was so advanced and was so sharp and dissonant and jagged that radio stations weren't going to be able to fit her into their formats.
And of course, at that time, you can't go straight to an audience. There's no streaming, obviously. There's no other way besides radio to draw attention to an artist like this.
Right. The gatekeepers did not have their gates open for her. And the other contemporaneous thing going on, Funkadelic put out its first album in 1970. They were established, more or less, but they were still an underground thing. You might hear them on a rhythm and blues station, but you wouldn't hear them on Top 40. You wouldn't hear them on a rock station. There was no outlet for them. And in our wonderful internet era, I think we forget how tightly those gates were kept. And also, one other thing is, she was a woman. How dare she? There was definitely a lot of overt sexism at the time. I mean, and there still is, right?
In addition to being a woman, she was a Black woman. And when we're talking about not fitting expectations, we have to think about what the expectations were for Black women at that time, what they're supposed to look like, how they're supposed to sound. And there was a definite desire or preference for what people thought of as a soulful vocal sound. And as John is saying, that's not what she was offering up as a jagged, dissonant, rough scream, scratch. She talked about herself as not being a vocalist, but as being a projector.
Yeah. In your article, that jumps out. It's just so dead right. You know what I mean? It's just so, it's such an apt descriptor of what she's doing.
And so when you think about that, the ideas at that time were that she could only be marketed to a Black audience. There wasn't even an effort to think about marketing her to a white audience. And so she's very limited. She's really boxed in, and she's doing something that's just completely out of the box.
This comes up both, Oliver, in your liner notes and Maureen in your article. She's not gospel trained. She's not church trained. And that is very unusual. And really where her vocal stylings are coming from, or the influences are being drawn from, are blues records and blues vocalists and a much less polished approach to vocalization. How atypical was that? It seems like it was very atypical at that moment.
It was not a time when most Black people her age, so in their, you know, in their 20s, were into the blues. That was not the sound that was carrying that generation of African Americans. Another outlier was Jimi Hendrix, who was really influenced by the blues and really into the blues. But that made her stand apart. And she was also taking not only the vocal sound and the kind of experimentation that you have in blues vocals, but also the lyrical content of the blues women of the 1920s, which was all about sexual desire, what the woman wanted, an expression of one's own sexual subjectivity. And that was coupled with her out of the box sound. That was a little bit too much, even in that era of sexual revolution.
Can we get into a little bit of the prehistory before she's recording for these albums? Betty moves to New York to go to FIT, becomes a model, maybe manages or operates a club. She's doing a lot. She's a mover in New York nightlife pretty quickly. She's meeting a lot of people. One of those people that she's meeting is Miles Davis. They end up having a relatively brief and, from what I can gather, fairly tumultuous marriage, where she later said that he was abusive.
She also transformed him. She made him contemporary. She changed his wardrobe from Italian suits to 1970s streetwear. She made him listen to Jimi Hendrix. She introduced him to Jimi Hendrix. She really was pivotal in his transformation from jazz to jazz rock funk, what he was doing with Bitches Brew. And she even titled Bitches Brew. He was going to call it Witches Brew, and she suggested alliteration.
How widely understood was that in the moment? I know we all know it now in rear view, but in the moment, was she understood to be architecting what Miles was doing?
I would say not at all.
Yeah. I mean, he does, to his credit, I did go back after she passed to double check Miles' 1990 autobiography, because my recollection was he did not devote very much space to talking about his relationship and marriage to Betty, which is true. He doesn't. She merits like maybe a few pages in one of his chapters. A lot of it is not terribly flattering. But at the same time, he doesn't necessarily give her credit for Bitches Brew, but does say how talented she was and that she did have a large influence on him, even if he wasn't really specific about what that influence meant. So I do think probably coming out of that, the autobiography at least, there might have been a reconsideration. But it's not like she takes up a lot of space in that autobiography at all.
I think he uses the expression, she was full of surprises. And you can interpret that as you will.
She is on the cover of Fi de Kilimanjaro, and there is a song on it called Mademoiselle Mabry. So her image is out there, but I remember at the time, here's a beautiful woman on the cover of Miles Davis' album. I didn't put it together that she was Mademoiselle Mabry.
One thing that comes up, and again, I'm forgetting if Oliver, if it's in your liner notes or Maureen in your article, but she gives an interview sometime in the 70s about the records that Miles produced for her. And she says something to the effect of, I could have signed with Clive or I could have made records with Ahmet, but I never was sure if they wanted me just because I was Miles's wife, or if they were basically taking me seriously strictly because of my association with Miles. And so ultimately, whatever those songs, there are a few songs, they eventually, many, many, many years later, did get released. But at that time, they just kind of went into the vault and she strikes out on her own.
And in fact, at the same time, and I think partly because one of the songs that she covered during those Columbia demo sessions was Politician Man by Cream, Clapton approached her about producing her. And I think she might have told this to other interviews as well, but I remember she mentioned to me, I don't have the exact quote, but the gist of it was, we just wouldn't have been a good fit because in effect, she was saying he was a little too conventional for my taste and I was just a lot more avant-garde and Clapton just wasn't interesting to me. So, I mean, she clearly had the ability to work with very, you know, well-known people, but I think because for her, she really wanted to carve her own lane, which is why a lot of the opportunities that I think maybe another artist might have tried to take advantage of being involved with someone like a Miles Davis or having being in the orbit of some of the people in his world. But for Betty, if she couldn't do it her way, she wasn't interested in doing it at all. And I think that is more or less held true for the entirety of her career.
I believe it's 72, she goes west to the Bay Area to work with Greg Errico, who had been in Sly's band. What do we know about the sessions that lead up to the making of her first album, which is the self-titled album in 1973?
Greg is, from my understanding, was assigned to her effectively by the folks at Just Sunshine. And Betty had already been going back and forth between New York and LA and San Francisco, partly for personal reasons. She was also a model during a lot of this time. And so she had modeling gigs in San Francisco. And this is sort of how she enters into the orbit of the San Francisco music scene, which, of course, in the late 60s, early 70s is incredibly rich. And so Errico and I think Larry Graham is also someone who plays on that first album. So, I mean, if you look at the talent she had on that first self-titled album on Just Sunshine, I mean, it's a murderer's row. I mean, she's got the Pointer Sisters and Sylvester singing backup for her. Let's just put that into perspective, right? And so the way in which Greg talked about how the production sessions went is Betty would effectively use a tape recorder and would sing or hum like bass lines and other melodic riffs and would give it to Errico to effectively translate that into, okay, so how would this actually look on the page or, you know, create an arrangement from it? But even if he was given the title of producer, I mean, effectively she was helping to produce all of her songs at that point. And then 1 year later is the lead producer. She now has jettisoned Errico. And it's not like they had a bad working relationship, but again, she just wanted to do it her way. So even early on, she's still having influence over, this is what I want my music to sound like. And of course, every single song on those albums, she writes.
At the top of the show, we were listening to Anti-Love Song, which is off of this record, which I think is probably my favorite song off this record. Let's maybe listen to another song off this record, which is less well known, but I think is very vivid. It's called Steppin' in Her I. Miller Shoes. Here we have a song celebrating the women of this scene, the women of this world, the vivacity, the style, the aliveness of what's happening. It's a musical representation of an extra musical lifestyle. It's how this song feels to me. Maureen, can you talk a little bit about some of the choices that Betty is making on this first album and then how she carries them over into the self-produced projects that come after?
One thing I wanted to say about that song in particular, I. Miller Shoes is about a specific woman that she knew who was part of the scene. She's singing about Devin Wilson, who died shortly after Jimi Hendrix. And Devin Wilson and Jimi Hendrix were sometime lovers, sometime friends, sometimes on the outs. But Devin was known as a groupie or a super groupie. And I think the attitude in the song that Betty Davis is putting forth is a sort of a celebration of Devin and what she represented, but also there's some critique in there that she could have been anything that she wanted, but, you know, she didn't do all that she might have done. So I think that exploration of what young, for the most part, single women were doing in the 70s, and especially the exploration of sexuality is a key theme for Betty Davis in these albums. And so she's exploring that lyrically. And then she's got this wide musical palette that she's playing with. So in terms of genre, she's kind of all over the map. You have the electric guitar very forward on a lot of the songs, which may make you think of rock. There can be distortion, distorted voices, certainly on a song like Game Is My Middle Name on the first album. And then she gets down into the blues on They Say I'm Different with that title track, where she sort of, she gives a litany of blues artists. These are the people that her grandparents listened to, and she was into this music, and she presents that music, that musical sound to us on that song. So, you know, she had big ears and big ideas, and she's exploring in so many different ways on these early albums.
JP, when you listen to, especially the shift from the 73 self-titled to They Say I'm Different, which is the next album where she's producing herself, what sticks out to you? What's the ideology that feels firm, Bette Davis ideology?
I actually hear continuity. I think she's already herself on the first album. I don't hear it as she got in the studio with all these famous people and was squelched. I think that she told them what to do, and then she told her band what to do. I hear the same architectural mind that she had. I mean, there's so much space in these songs. There's so many weird intervals. There's so much syncopation and silence. I'm kind of baffled that more of these songs didn't get sampled sooner, though Ice Cube grabbed one. To go back to the I, Millie song, though, I mean, that song is a death song. It's about her taking to drugs. It's very realistic and hard-nosed. And then on They Say I'm Different, there's Don't Call Her No Tramp, which is about sex workers. And it's saying, they've made this decision. Don't denounce them for it. It's very advanced. Apparently, NAACP thought that it was not doing good things for African-American images and didn't want that song played. But I think it's a really strong and forthright and forward-looking song. Don't Call Her No Tramp.
Let's actually listen to a little bit of Don't Call Her No Tramp, which is, again, from the second album, They Say I'm Different.
Are you gone? An elegant hustler, but don't you call on no tramp.
I read this article in the New York Times about Sinead O'Connor that completely shattered my previously held beliefs.
This is the kind of journalism I just didn't expect to really see. Talking about John Coltrane, one of my heroes, and
Gustavo Cerati, you know, one of the most iconic rock stars in Latin America.
I listened to this episode of The Daily, and I thought it was doing a good job trying to explain the French point of view.
It's made me a lot more thoughtful in trying to look at different perspectives.
My father, we don't agree, but I often text him articles and we'll discuss it later.
The New York Times is my doorway. It's my connection to the world.
My name is Marco.
I'm Jordan.
Vera.
Victoire. I've been a subscriber of the New York Times for 6 years.
21 years.
From the time I was a child.
The New York Times for me is about
the joy of uncovering something new in the world.
Find out how the New York Times
can fit into your life
at nytimes.com/life.
So something that all three of you have in common that a lot of people don't share with you is everybody on this episode has interviewed Bette Davis. Is that correct?
True.
I have, yeah.
Yes.
And Bette did not do loads of interviews in her early career. And then after she disappeared around 1980, basically was not talking to anybody really up until probably Oliver, till the liner note interviews that you did with her circa 2007 and 2008. In those conversations that you had, one thing that I picked up just from the quotes that each of you have used in your pieces, and if I'm reading this wrong, let me know, but she did not talk much about the life that she was leading while she was writing these songs, or the connection between the life she was leading while she was writing these songs. I might be wrong, but I feel like I'm not picking up a lot of that, at least in the interview snippets that end up in all the things that you've written. Maybe talk me through what Bette Davis's life was like during these 3, 4, 5 years of productivity and the connections between the life and the songwriting, the lyricism.
Well, I just found her very reticent. She was very laconic. I think, Maureen, you mentioned this in your book chapter too. She was very deliberate in what she wanted to talk about and what she wanted to say. And she wasn't that interested in describing her past. When I talked to her about her performances, she said, I'm paraphrasing here, but she said everybody has two sides, a quiet side and an aggressive side, and she brought out her aggressive side on stage to match the intensity of the music, which of course she had written, but it was hard to get her to go beyond that.
Maureen, how did these kinds of topics, how were they addressed in your conversations?
Well, I had a similar experience to what John described, and before I spoke with her, I was in contact with Oliver, who warned me that it was probably going to be a challenging interview because she was not a loquacious person. And that was definitely what I experienced. And there were things, as John said, things that she wanted to talk about, and that's where we rested. But she did not go on at length about anything. What she did talk about, and I think what was really important to her, was that she was a songwriter. And I think that's how she thought of herself. You know, that was like the primary occupation. And she did these other things. She was a performer. She sang. But I think it was the songwriting that was so special to her. And that's something that comes through in the documentary. She's a writer. And that these songs were vehicles for her writing and for the performance. But to get her to talk in detail about anything is sort of, you know, reflect on. I was very interested in what her experience was as a Black woman in a male-dominated context. And she said, there were no problems. She basically was saying it wasn't anything that she really thought about. I think it was just, she was really focused. There was this thing she wanted to do. And that's where her energy went. It wasn't thinking about the things that weren't letting her do the thing. And when those things became too much of an issue, she just stepped away. And you know, that retreat at the end of the 70s, and then no one heard from her for a couple of decades.
Bette Davis as a songwriter is really, I think, relevant to trying to understand what the relationship was between who she was sort of in quote-unquote real life versus the persona that she was putting on record and putting on stage. And in my conversations with her, I mean, she made it pretty clear that her music was not meant to be taken as autobiographical. And so as much as people wanted to read into a song like one of her, I think, songs off her first album was called He Was a Big Freak, and people, because they knew about her relationship with Miles, you know, thought, oh my God, she's talking about Miles Davis. And she was very quick to say, no, this was a song that was sort of an amalgam of men that she has known, or just her general take on sort of men, but not specifically any one person. And I think, as Maureen and John both indicated, you know, she was very, very cagey about how much she revealed about the relationship between her personal life and her artistic life, especially when she began giving interviews again, circa 2006, 2007. I think you can probably find a little bit more candor if you go back to magazine interviews with her from the 70s, in which she might have addressed some of this with, again, a little bit more candor than I think she was much, much more protected about it in the last act of her life and career. But I think in general, what you can think of is that there was a Bette Davis as a person who certainly was inspired to create like this persona that was supersized in many ways, larger than life, certainly, that may have had elements of who she was as a person in, again, quote unquote, real life, but in general was a performance, was a creation out of her imagination about the kind of different kinds of Bettys that she wanted to be able to put out there. And so I think as desirable or as, you know, as much as we want to be able to try to read this kind of one-to-one relationship between her private life and her public persona, her point was always, you know, don't get it twisted. Like, this is a performance. I'm giving you a persona. And especially because her onstage performance was so radical at the time. Burlesque is how a lot of people described it. But like, this is someone who was an introvert, was not a drinker, did not smoke, did not do drugs. I guess partied a little bit more earlier in her 20s when she was coming up in the scene. But by and large, when she was actually making music, was sort of just about making the music. And so the perception that we have of her on record is very different, I believe, from what the life that she was actually living during that time.
Should we talk a little bit about the third album? Because there is this shift. She does go to a major label. But what ends up happening is the record is not as successful critically or commercially or attention-wise. This is Nasty Gal, the third album. Shout out Sophia Amoruso. What happened? Is it that the album itself is a little bit more lackluster? It does feel that way to me, listening to them all back to back. Was it a marketing thing? Was it exhaustion? Was it that everybody had caught up? What do you think was going on in 75 when this record comes out?
Vivian Goldman, who was a music writer, but also someone who was working in the record industry around the time that Bette Davis was on Island Records, she writes about Nasty Gal, specifically about the song Dedicated to the Press, that unfortunately, in her mind, Bette Davis had started paying too much attention to the commentary about her. And in the song Dedicated to the Press, she actually quotes from articles that critics had, who had seen her performances, had written about her. These are unfavorable reviews. So I think the first lines of the song are extra, extra, have you heard about me or have you read about me? And so it's sort of like in trying to understand why she wasn't getting the foothold that you might want to have as an artist, the record sales. She started looking at the press, she started looking at the critical writing, and she sort of internalized some of it. And the song is meant to say, I don't really care what you think. But I think once you're writing a song that says, I don't care, it's some indication that you actually do care, that it does matter. And one of the things that she says in the song is, you know, you don't understand me. So if you can't understand me, how can you like my music? And it's that going back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, that she was so different. She was so out there in terms of her sound, her visual image, the lyrical content, that it just didn't compute at that time. And so by the time of Nasty Gal, it seems like she's responding to the way people were responding to her. And maybe that took her a little bit off track.
Let's listen to a touch of Dedicated to the Press from Nasty Gal.
I know!
So there are recordings and eventually albums that are shelved, that get made after Nasty Gal. They come out many, many, many years later in the wake of this other reissue series. And then after 1980, nothing. She lost her father. She spent some time with silent monks in Japan and came back and tapped out. And again, this comes up in your interviews in different ways. It seems dramatic from the outside looking in, but when she talks about it, she seems to talk about it as just like a natural, well, I had done what I came to do. No, there was no more to do. No one was knocking on my door. And so I fell off the scene. How unusual was that at the time? Was it noted at the time that she had essentially vanished from music making?
Well, not really. I mean, lots of people vanish from music making. But I want to circle back to Island for a second, which is to say, when she moved to a major labels want hits. Major labels want that radio hit. Just Sunshine Records could probably get by with laudatory press and with people falling over themselves at concerts. But you get to Island, it's like, where's the radio hit? But also, I think it speaks to the incredible stupidity of Island Records that they didn't put out another album, that they didn't trust her enough to make a hit. It's just crazy to me to have somebody with this much incandescent talent, with this much skill, and just drop her. She made another album. She made Is It Love or Desire with her band after touring, this hot band, Funk House, with two of her cousins in it. Went down to Bogalusa, recorded a whole album. Island shelved it. They didn't even put it out. It's crazy to me that it had to sit around all those decades just for us to get to hear it.
The Miles sessions were put out. There is the Lost album that was released by Light in the Attic as well. Is there not also another album or more Bette Davis music kind of still on the verge of being reissued?
Well, there is. There's an album called Crashing with Passion. She got an English fan to finance sessions in Los Angeles with people like Herbie Hancock, Alphonse Muzon on drums, Martha Reeves of the Vandellas on backup vocals. And it's another album that's been in the vaults for all these years. Light in the Attic is supposed to be reissuing it later this year. I'm going to be eager to hear it.
Do we know much about how that album sounds compared to the ones that we've already heard in reissued?
No.
I've heard really bad rips of it that had been swapped online like years ago. And it was a disco era. So I think the production certainly is going to be a little bit different from what I recall. Again, my memory at the time is I just didn't like what I heard as much as what she was putting out in the mid-70s. But again, I also wasn't really listening to a really high-quality version of it. And it'll be very interesting to see its comparison, because it does come from, you know, about 4 or 5 years after at least Nasty Gal came out. So one would expect maybe some differences in production style and what have you.
And also, I assume part of what would be at play is by that point, a lot of people are making records that she was doing 5-6 years earlier, that she, you know, that she was being the progenitor of. Other folks have caught up to her. So it'd be interesting to hear what she delivers as the landscape is changing and kind of more in tune with where she had been in 1973 and 1974.
You have to remember that the whole commercial landscape was changing. Rhythm and blues was giving away to disco, and disco was killing careers right and left for people who had come out of blues and come out of gospel. And I think that was probably part of Island's calculation in letting her go so soon, was that disco was king and Bette Davis was old hat. So I'll be very curious to hear it, but with the kind of musicians she had on it, with Chuck Rainey and Herbie Hancock and Alphonse Mouzon, I don't think it's going to be a typical disco record. I'm hoping for the best.
Oliver, what was the path that Bette Davis's records took in between 1980 and then the 2007 reissues that eventually led to the resurgence of interest and the attention that they eventually garnered and now that we're kind of basking in?
John, I think you really touched on this at the top, which was that she was rediscovered in the 90s and the 00s by a younger generation of crate diggers, people looking for samples. The other John mentioned how Ice Cube sampled Shubidoob and Coppin' for his first solo album all the way back in 1990. So there were these ways in which her music was beginning to get rediscovered throughout those decades. And I think partly because she had disappeared so fully off the map. I write about this in my liners and just the kind of rumors that filled that void of information, because she had just gone very, very private. And so there was this mystique around, like, you know, who was this person? What's happened to her? And this began, I think, to slowly build momentum in a lot of ways, thanks to the, you know, the creation of the internet. People who had individually had a fascination with Bette were now able to exchange notes with one another. And so you would have these collectors that had been for years collecting different kind of ephemera, now able to share these resources, which in a lot of ways led to her being rediscovered specifically by John Ballen, I believe is his name, who did the first, as far as I know, the first post-1970s interview with her for Wax Poetics magazine. I think that was in 2006. And the folks at Light in the Attic, who eventually reissued most of her albums, they were also part of that generation of kind of crate diggers who were interested in soul and funk music from the past. And someone like Bette, not just because of her music, not just because of her image, not just because of her backstory, but because of all of these things, that intense fascination is once it became clear that, okay, Bette is A, still alive, because that was something that a lot of people weren't sure about. And number two, she's willing to talk to people again. I think Light in the Attic was like, we want to be in the Bette Davis business. And they went through John to speak with her, got her on board in terms of being able to reissue the albums and obviously licensed it through Michael Lang and Just Sunshine, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's really with 07, when those first reissues come out, is it had taken what had previously been all of this deeply underground interest in Bette from across the world and given it a focus in terms of, okay, now she's willing to talk to people again. Her albums are now going to be something that you can find outside of a dusty record bin someplace. And that rediscovery, I think, you know, came with understanding how you can draw all of these through lines between contemporary, not just Black independent musicians, but women musicians, but certainly within that cadre of contemporary ones, whether it's your Janelle Monáes or your Erykah Badus, your Joys, your Beyoncés, and then drawing it all the way back there, it's like, wow, look at them side by side, listen to their music, listen to what they have to say. And I think all of those reasons go into sort of how her music was rediscovered. The albums had been buried in the vault, the demo tapes from Columbia that apparently Miles's estate had been refusing to release. It created the ability for labels to now be able to coax these things out of the vaults and bring them into fuller view.
You know, you mentioned she obviously sits for interviews with you at that time, but there's still a reluctance. There is still this reticence. To what degree do you get the sense that she was gratified by the resurgent interest in her music? Because even if she's kind of inching out of obscurity to participate in the reissue campaign and later in the documentary, she doesn't go back on the road. She's not sitting for televised interviews. It's nothing like that. Do you get the sense that she's taking deep pleasure in it? Or is it more just like, well, okay, I guess this is what's happening now, in the same way that they stopped calling in 1980, they started calling again in 2006, and I took the call?
Well, I think she just kept her cards really close to her chest. And I asked her that direct question, and I think her response was, it's nice, but like, that was it, you know? And I think in a lot of ways, maybe to your point, John, her action speaks really loudly, which is that there are other artists who have been rediscovered who really, you know, they triple down on that by re-recording and getting back into the studio with you know, famous contemporaries and all these things. And I mean, we know what that looks like. And Betty made very specific decisions, right? Informed decisions. I do not want to do that. That is not going to be my route. Like, the city of Pittsburgh wanted to do a Betty Davis Day when the documentary about her, They Say I'm Different, came out a few years ago. And I think she was kind of willing, but not really that interested in being back in the public spotlight. And notably, one of the things that people remark about that documentary, which is about her, is that she never appears in it in full profile. To this day, I have no idea. And I've interviewed her several times at least, right? I have no idea what she looks like now, because that's her decision. She wanted to keep things really, really private, really close to the chest, and was not interested in being rediscovered in the way that you're talking about. One of Betty's close friends and confidants, especially at the end of her life, she was with Betty when she passed away the other week, is a ethnomusicology professor at the University of Pittsburgh, Danielle Maggio, who has written the liner notes to a forthcoming reissue and is working on the first ever, as far as I know of, biography of Betty Davis. And if anyone is going to have answers and inside information, it would be her. Though, again, I wouldn't be surprised if, again, we don't learn that much more about Betty's interior private life, but I would love to be wrong about that. And hopefully Danielle's got the inner lane on that. And again, Betty began as a songwriter, and it really seems like at the end of her life, that's what was most important to her, is I want to write songs. I don't care necessarily about being out there performing or even recording, but I want people to take my songs seriously.
Maureen, what can we say about the inheritors of Betty Davis? Whether it's a Janelle Monáe, a Joy, or even a Rick James or a Prince. Because you don't have to have your albums in circulation to have influence. And it certainly seems clear that in the 1980s, there are people who had mainline Betty Davis records and figured out ways to incorporate those aesthetics and ideas into their own music. And it carries forward all the way up to the current day.
I wanted to respond to your earlier question, and then I'll talk about inheritors. I think Betty Davis's decision not to try to do a second act in the 2000s, go back on the stage, really speaks to how smart she was and how careful she was about controlling her image. She knew that there is very little footage of her performing in the 70s. There's a little clip that you can see in the Miles Davis documentary, Birth of the Cool. There's I think it's the same clip that you see in the They Say I'm Different video or documentary. But it's really a tiny, tiny bit. And so as we're all talking about her and thinking about her and listening to her music, we hear about these amazing, challenging performances, we haven't seen them. So that's part of the mystique also, that we know about her is what people talk about and the records from the 1970s and some photographs. They're great photographs of her. But that the absence of the moving visual image and not having her visual image in the 2000s, I think creates something, a kind of mystique about her that makes us want to get closer, even though we can't quite get there. So I think she was really smart in doing that in terms of managing the product, the work that she had created, which includes the image that she created. As far as her inheritors, I think for me, the most obvious one and the one I like to think about because it's so close to the time that she stepped away is Prince. Prince, we know, was an omnivorous listener. He listened across all genres. And so, you know, he would have known about Betty Davis. And when we look at him in the Dirty Mind phase, we can look at Dirty Mind by Prince and Nasty Gal by Betty Davis. During the Nasty Gal tour, she was wearing lingerie and then she wore a raincoat over the lingerie and she'd come out on stage and the band was playing and then she would get to the mic. And at some point during that first song, she would drop the raincoat to reveal herself in lingerie. And if you look at Prince's videos from the Dirty Mind era, I think it might be this, maybe it's the song Dirty Mind itself. He's wearing a raincoat and I think it's a black thong, which is not typical clothing for black men in 1980 or so. So I think he picked that up from Betty Davis. And then around that time, a little bit later, he creates a girl group called Vanity Six who wear lingerie and sing a song called Nasty Girl. So I think that that's such a literal picking up where Betty Davis left off, but you also get some of her energy in his musical performances, in that very upfront sexuality that Prince is known for. That's exactly what Betty Davis was doing in the 70s.
JP, where do you see the long arc of Betty Davis's influence? Where do you see it most prominent?
As Maureen said, it goes through Prince, it goes through Janet Jackson, it goes through Erykah Badu, it goes through Macy Gray. It goes to all of these performers who were looking for open, uninhibited, musically gifted forebears discovered her as their ancestor. And I don't know if it was from crate digging in the 80s and 90s or if it's from the reissues, but it just does seem to expand as a sublayer of everybody who's addressing the same questions of desire and strength and need.
Before we go, we've played some of the kind of like better known, maybe more obvious Betty Davis records. Maybe we should play little snippets if each of you want to pick one that's maybe a little less well known and talk through kind of what sticks in your head about it. Oliver, do you want to start with one?
My favorite song is by her is Shooby Doop and Coppin, but that's also not, it's not a deep copy. It's one of her big hits. To me, it's just the funkiness of it just leaps off the record, the first bar that you hear. And it's such a groove. I mean, it's no wonder Sir Jinx looped it up for Cube back in 1990. I mean, this is, I'm amazed it wasn't used more because it is such a groove.
Girl, she's a fine, fine, fine. Lord knows the show is fine. Gals, I can't help myself.
She's gonna do it.
Maureen, do you have one that you want to bless the people with?
I would like to bless the people with Game Is My Middle Name. It's a vocal clinic in terms of experimentation and going out to the very edge. And when you hear people talk about Betty Davis as a kind of proto-punk figure, I think this is a song that you can point to hear that.
JP, we're going to go out with yours, but I'll do my outro first. That is our show. Thank you to Maureen, Oliver, JP. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com, with any questions, comments, or concerns. Get in the Facebook group, get on the Discord, subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Google, Apple, Stitcher, yada, 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 yada. Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media is our producer, and we're going to go out on JP's pick. JP, what do we got?
This is a shallow cut, but I love it. It's If I'm in Luck, I Might Get Picked Up. It's the first song on her first album. It just announces Betty Davis in all of her glory.
This is a hell of a song. If I'm in Luck, I Might Get Picked Up. Betty Davis. Till next week.
just me.